Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Joy Lesnick, Acting Commissioner of the National Center for Education Evaluation and Regional Assistance within the U.S. Department of Education. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Kirsten Schroeder. So, Joy, I'd like to explore in more depth what are the factors that have contributed to the growing body of evidence for the effectiveness of government programs, in your case, education programs?
Sure. Well, one of the key 2014 to 2015 priorities of the department, as described in the Secretary's 2014 to 18 strategic plan, is to enable evidence-based decision-making. And one of the ways the plan lays out how to get there is to invest in research and evaluation that builds evidence for education improvement, communicates findings effectively, and drive the use of evidence in decision-making by internal and external stakeholders. So researchers, just by the nature of what we do, are usually trying to build on the existing body of evidence that exists to produce new evidence to support, dispute, or extend that cumulative body of knowledge. It's not that different from what humans do when trying to figure out how things work or the best way to do things. For example, if you move to a new city, over the first few months, you probably try out a few different routes to drive, walk, or train to work to get to work. You're probably trying to figure out which one is fastest, or has the fewest stops, or is the cheapest, or is the one that passes the coffee shop you like to go to on the way so you can easily pop in. That's all a form of research. It's probably not systematic, unless you time yourself each day and keep a log of the weather and construction and delays. And you can't ever determine which way is best on a given day unless someone else leaves your house the same time as you do and takes the opposite route at the same speed you would. And then you can compare how long it took. And actually, you can't determine which way is the best overall or on average without repeating that during different seasons, different times of day, with different forms of transportation, etc. I think you get my point. When we use evidence like that to make decisions, we are also incorporating judgments about what's important to us. In this case, convenience, time, efficiency, cost, coffee, etc. Over the past few decades, there has been a growing consensus that what matters when making decisions in education is whether a program, policy, practice, or approach improves student outcomes, and particularly the outcomes that we can measure, like performance on tests, graduating from high school, student behavior, things like that. And this growing consensus has translated into a growing body of evidence about the effectiveness of programs across the education research field. IES has been a leader in funding evaluations of programs towards this end since it was established in 2002, including investing in training programs to support researchers in learning how to do this kind of work, like predoctoral fellowships, postdoctoral fellowships, training on statistical methods, and training for how to use federal longitudinal databases, just to name a few.
So you mentioned earlier in your response that when you're talking about evaluation or evidence or policymaking, that policymakers tend to speak different languages than practitioners and researchers. And as I was getting ready for this interview, you know, there's a lot of terminology in this area. And I'd like to talk specifically about certain words that are used all the time and sort of delve into their definition. Would you define for us what is meant by evidence and what is meant by program effectiveness? And what do you mean by rigorous evidence and how important it is to your work?
Sure. That's a great question because evidence can be a lot of things. Certainly, we're not talking about evidence from a crime scene, like in a courtroom setting here. Certainly not. In education, evidence is somewhat of an umbrella term for what we learn from doing all kinds of research. And it's also a bit of a shorthand because what we mean at IES and NCE when talking about evidence is evidence about the effectiveness of interventions. And I use that term, interventions, to mean programs, policies, practices, and approaches. So evidence can mean positive findings, negative findings, or a finding that the intervention you studied had similar outcomes in the treatment group where you used the intervention as compared to outcomes for students in the comparison or the control group. So when there's evidence about the effectiveness of an intervention, a decision maker in education has another piece of information to use to make their decision. So it's not always that positive findings mean that the decision maker will adopt or should adopt that intervention. The evidence could be a small positive finding that costs a lot of money to achieve, and the decision maker has to weigh whether or not that intervention is worth the cost. The evidence of effectiveness could also be a finding of what we call no difference, which is when the study found that the new intervention doesn't improve the outcomes you were looking at compared to what you were already doing. But if there are other aspects of that intervention that are desirable to you as a decision maker, maybe it's cheaper, maybe people like it more, maybe it includes more updated information, then you, as the decision maker, may still decide to adopt that intervention in a school. But the bottom line is that you need that evidence of effectiveness to be able to consider it in your decision, and you need it to be rigorous. In effectiveness studies, that means that the research study was designed to determine whether the intervention caused the change in the outcomes. It's tricky because we're talking about humans here. If you have a seed and don't put it in soil and don't water it and don't give it sun, it won't grow, no matter how long you wait. But in most cases, a fourth grader will know more math at the end of the school year than at the beginning of the school year, just because 9 months have gone by. So to see if a new math curriculum is related to students learning more, then you need two groups of students, one group that receives the curriculum and the other one that doesn't, or receives a different curriculum. And those groups have to be similar to each other, so we can have confidence that the math curriculum itself was the reason for the change in their math achievement and not because of something else. Maybe that one group was already performing higher to begin with, that one group had an especially good teacher, that one group had a disruption in their school year because of a flood, or whatever the case may be. Those groups have to be similar, like the example I gave earlier of someone leaving your house at the same time that you do to try out which way is the fastest way to get to work that day. So the best way to get similar groups in your treatment and comparison groups is to start with the whole pool together and then randomly assign students or classrooms or schools or whatever group you're looking at to either the treatment group or the comparison group to either get the intervention or to not get the intervention. This is the classic randomized control trial, or RCT. You can have similar groups in other ways too, but the RCT is the best way to do it because it accounts for similarities in groups that you can measure, like test scores and age and gender, and things that you can't measure, like motivation and interest and persistence and things like that. So when you have a study that's designed with two equivalent groups, then you're on your way to being able to make conclusions based on what we call causal inferences. You can have a higher degree of confidence that the findings from the study are because of that intervention and not because of something else. And so the What Works Clearinghouse uses a rating of effectiveness studies to help people know how much confidence to have in those findings. And that highest rating is meets What Works Clearinghouse standards without reservations, and that means we have very high confidence in the findings and that the intervention was responsible for those findings. Again, whatever the findings are, they could be positive, negative, or no difference, but the rating is telling you about the confidence we have in whatever those findings are. And then the second highest rating for the What Works Clearinghouse is meets What Works Clearinghouse standards with reservations. This means that the study was designed in a way where we have some confidence in the findings, but not as much as if it were an RCT, which is what you need to get the highest rating.
So I'd like to talk about the basics of the What Works Clearinghouse, and then I'll pass it off to Kirsten and you to talk more about the specifics. But can you tell us, when was it created, why was it created, and what topics does it focus on?
Well, the What Works Clearinghouse, or I call it the Clearinghouse for short, it's a central location for high-quality evidence of the effectiveness of interventions in education from preschool to post-secondary, and we even look at interventions that aim to improve teacher outcomes. The Clearinghouse determines the quality of effectiveness studies in education, and one way to describe that what we do is to say we study the existing studies. And what I mean by that is that we look at studies of the effectiveness of interventions, effectiveness studies only, determine how each study was conducted, that's how it was designed, how many different students were in the different groups, how the outcomes were measured, and how the analyses were conducted, and then based on that analysis, make a determination about how much confidence to have in the findings from those studies. We apply a set of standards about high-quality effectiveness research and judge all studies against the same criteria, which is all publicly available on the What Works Clearinghouse website, which is whatworks.ed.gov. If you know the standards and criteria when you review a study, you should come to the same conclusions we do. You may disagree with the standards, though I'd say there is a general consensus across fields about the basics of what's needed to make causal inferences about the effectiveness of interventions. But the standards are all applied to studies in the same way. The What Works Clearinghouse was established in 2002. We had our first reports in 2005. And it was modeled after similar efforts in other fields to conduct systematic reviews, namely the Cochrane Collaboration in Medicine and the Campbell Collaboration in Crime and Justice, Education, International Development, and Social Welfare. And the reason to have this centralized location is because there are lots of studies out there in education and other fields, and lots of findings, and there really does need to be one place where you can find them all, alongside a judgment about which are of the highest quality. And so the clearinghouse aims to make the job of a decision maker a little bit easier. If they can get a summary of the highest quality evidence that we have about an intervention or approach, then they can use that in their decision. It's really better than relying on one study, and it's certainly much more efficient than every decision maker doing a review of all of the studies every time a decision needs to be made, which is, of course, impossible. And so when I'm talking about decision makers in education, the people I'm referring to includes a number of different audiences. For example, it could be a state-level policymaker looking at teacher incentives. It could be teachers deciding how to teach problem solving to middle school students. It could be superintendents selecting a district-wide reading curriculum. It could be a researcher or a developer looking to build on the existing evidence base. It could even be Congress. Anyone who is looking to make a decision in education is a potential user of the What Works Clearinghouse.
This is quite fascinating, and particularly from the area in the areas of knowledge management. And as you just described, the idea of developing this clearinghouse to address these various stakeholders from principals, superintendents, down to the teacher classroom. So in your description, wanted to kind of dive a little bit further into what were the foundational principles that underlay the clearinghouse? And, you know, how does it synthesize evaluation findings in ways that make research useful to decision makers, researchers, and practitioners in the field?
Well, to be seen as a trusted source of information, which is really our goal, the foundational principle of the clearinghouse is credibility. And I think we achieve that with our rigorous standards, the transparency of our reviews, and an adjudication process that allows anyone to disagree with the results of a review, which will always prompt the clearinghouse to look at it again to make sure the review was done correctly and completely. All of the clearinghouse's products and resources are designed to make the evidence accessible and easy to use. And to describe what I mean by that, I'll talk through four obstacles and then how the clearinghouse has tried to address them. So first, there's the challenge of availability. Research articles are not hard to find if you have an internet connection and a trusty search engine. But most of the time, the article you find is behind a paywall. And you have to pay for the article if you don't have access to a university library, which many district and state-level education decision makers do not. Next, there's the problem of scale. That same Google search may bring up 10 reports on a particular intervention, and probably 10 times that. It's really pretty daunting how many studies you might return from that search. Third, there's the issue of quality. So given all of the available studies, which one should I look at first, and which ones are going to provide the best evidence? And, oh, by the way, since when did I need a PhD in statistics to do my job well? It's pretty frustrating. And finally, of course, is the challenge of time. Who has time to track down all of the research and read and evaluate it all in the first place? A decision maker has lots of other things to do that might be bus schedules to upcoming legislation. It could be grading papers and so on. So the clearinghouse tries to address all of these obstacles by searching for all of the studies on an intervention, retrieving the actual reports or articles, and reading all of them. Really, every word, every table, every footnote. The clearinghouse reviewers read it all and review it all. And that solves the availability and scale problems. Then the clearinghouse assesses the quality of the evidence from each study to determine effectiveness. And as I mentioned earlier, the amount of confidence we can have in the findings of an effectiveness study depends entirely on how the study was designed and executed. And finally, the clearinghouse summarizes the findings from the studies that meet the bar in one of our reports.
Super. So the clearinghouse is this wealth of information you've just described, another function assessing the quality and then providing a summary. Now, let me ask, who exactly performs the work that ends up in the clearinghouse?
So I'll answer this in two ways. First, the clearinghouse is an IES investment of about $10 million per year. The work is done through 5 contracts and coordinated by a small team of staff at IES. So the contractors have distinct tasks, such as maintaining the website, reviewing studies, developing reports in kindergarten through 12th grade or post-secondary education. They may be producing a practice guide or doing a quick turnaround review of studies. But the 4 non-website contracts all have tasks for reviewing studies, so it's really important that the IES staff are coordinating that work. The studies that those contractors are reviewing were done by education researchers in a variety of settings. It could be universities, nonprofit organizations, for-profit developers, school districts, research firms, federal agencies, or elsewhere. A research study only needs to be public for the WhatWorks Clearinghouse to review it. It does not have to be peer-reviewed or published. So the WhatWorks Clearinghouse reviews include that gray literature in this way as well. So this is things like dissertations and master's theses, and they're all included in the systematic reviews. ERIC, which is the Education Resources Information Clearinghouse, is at eric.ed.gov. That's a great place for authors to submit their work for public availability. ERIC is an online library of education research and information. It's actually been around since 1964. That's also in our center and a great place to make that information public without it being published.
How does the NCEE ensure the widespread dissemination of its research findings? We will ask Joy Lesnick, its acting commissioner, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.